Our first presenter is Mr. Aaron Vissman. And Aaron is research focuses on the determinants of health in migrant populations. He is currently a third-year doctoral student in behavioral sciences and health education at Emory University under the supervision of Dr. Hannah Cooper. His presentation today offers initial findings from Dr. Cooper's study entitled Public Housing Relocations, Impact on HIV Risk and Drug Use. His presentation is entitled Social Networks and Substance Abuse Trajectories, Initial Outcomes from a Study of Planned Migration in Atlanta.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thanks, everyone, for coming. Excuse me, I'm going to look at my notes a bit through this presentation because I have a bunch of details I'm going to try to cover that I think are important in understanding this study approach. So although we're focused on public housing residents in Atlanta, there's a really good chance that people near where you live are also affected by the same policy, federal policy of planned migration, because it's a federal policy and it really affects the whole country. I don't have any disclosures. So there's been sort of a paradigm shift in public housing policy at federal level, beginning in the 1980s and going through the 90s and on until today, where basically there's been a sort of a concern, I guess, about these super blocks or campuses where lots of poverty is sort of concentrated. And you can think about maybe Cabrini Green in Chicago, the towers that have been demolished, or if you've watched the HBO series The Wire, they have towers that are portrayed in that, and part of the plot line is actually includes a Hope Six demolition over the course of that series. Basically some of these complexes obviously fall into disrepair from lack of federal funding over time. And that also leads to sort of have these communities vulnerable to the forces of gentrification. And the paradigm shift that I was talking about basically is one where I guess the policy seeks to relocate residents to more spatially dispersed areas. So it's an effort to move residents to subsidized rental units in the private market. They're geographically dispersed to sort of spread out the concentrated poverty. And the Hope Six really exemplifies that paradigm shift. And you could say that the renaming of the Section 8 program as a housing choice voucher program sort of denotes the paradigm shift as well, because it's trying to increase sort of personal choice and private investment, of course, into this sort of federal policy. Hope Six defines severely distressed public housing based on rates of drug-related crime and violence and poverty and the impact on the neighboring community. There isn't exactly a federal definition for these crime rates, but they're more in relation to the surrounding neighborhoods. So there's sort of the local housing authority or state housing people can sort of determine which complexes are kind of bringing down the surrounding areas, surrounding neighborhoods. Since 1994, I guess I should mention that there's been, in between 93 and 94, there's about $7.4 billion spent on Hope Six programs. And since 94, it's facilitated the migration of more than 100,000 households in 193 cities from concentrated complexes to voucher-subsidized rental units in the private market. I should also mention that most of the people in these severely distressed housing complexes throughout the country are either Latino or African-American, and in the Atlanta communities that we focused on, it's pretty much 100% African-American. And despite the wide application of this program, there's been pretty limited research into the health of individuals who've been displaced by Hope Six and similar policies. Williams, who I cite there, sort of identified high substance use rates within these communities, and they're sort of defined as such, so that's not especially surprising. And our formative research in the Atlanta communities that were slated for demolition indicated higher rates of substance use as well. There's sort of a review of the moving to opportunity literature by Acevedo Garcia, and they reported really very little about substance abuse outcomes, some smoking-related outcomes in alcohol, but that's about it. So what's pretty clear is that neighborhood and interpersonal contexts for movers affected by these programs change, and these changes may well be linked to health and coping behaviors. Research unrelated to housing policy kind of recently has incorporated social network variables, and you can think of the Framingham Heart Study has gotten a lot of publicity, and they included social network change and found that adding a social network member, not surprisingly, over time, if that person was a heavy drinker, you're more likely to drink heavily in the future, and also if they were an abstainer, then you're more likely to abstain from alcohol use in the future. And in the SHIELD study in Baltimore, they were also looking at social network variables, and they found that increased social network density, so how well my network members know one another over time, and also reducing the number of injection drug users who identify in my social network. Both of those things were health protective against drug overdose. Both of those studies, and most social network studies that look at time, are problematic in some sense because you don't know if changes in the network are preceding alcohol or substance use, or if your own substance use is sort of leading you to change your network. So that's one of the nice things about looking at the Hope 6 relocations in Atlanta the way that we are, is that we have some sense of the chain of events because we know that people are sort of forced into a different social setting and geographic setting. And over time, over the course of this study, we'll look at trajectories and try to model network change to the best we can. So the research questions that I'm looking at are, do social networks and perceptions of social support change pre-post locations, and are changes in network characteristics and social support associated with changes in substance misuse and or abuse? Here's our sample. We have 172 residents of seven relocating public housing communities in Atlanta. All African-American, over 18, sexually active in the past year, recruited through multiple methods. And we purposively oversampled substance users to get about a 20% of the sample who was scoring positive on our substance dependency scale. There's four waves of data collection have actually been collected thus far. Wave one is pre-location, and we've been following up at 6-month intervals, and it goes for a total of, I guess, 8 waves, 4 years, that is. But I'm only looking at wave one and wave two. We've got a lot of other measures, but I'm not going to talk about all of them today. Talk about a pretty small set of individual level measures. So, and I said on the other slide that we're looking at egocentric networks, so it just indicates that we're only looking at out-ties, who I choose as my social network, and not necessarily in-ties, people that choose me, which is somewhat of a limitation. But we used the Arizona support inventory, interview schedule, and it's a pretty big set of questions, and it gets at three general aspects of the social networks. And the three aspects that I'm looking at is the total network size, the names of the network reference generated by the schedule, the sort of relationships that people, the numbers of relationships with different types of people listed here, and then different aspects of social support. So we ask about specific types of relationships in the first four or five questions, and then go on to ask, do you know someone who can offer you material aid when you need it? Or has there been someone who can offer you material aid when you needed it in the past 6 months? And if that person isn't already nominated as sort of part of the social network, then we add them and then ask, you know, the same sort of relationship questions. So I can at the end, if you have questions about this instrument, I could probably address those. But (clears throat) our measures, the outcome measures that we're looking at right now for substance abuse are the TCU dependency scale, and that corresponds approximately with the DSM manual for clinical diagnosis of substance dependency for alcohol or drugs if you score greater than 3 or equal to 3. And we're using the standard sort of Burfest measures for binge drinking, where they're different for men and women. For the analysis, use basic data screening steps, t-tests where appropriate, regression using mixed models to account for clustering in public housing complex at baseline. We used Poisson regression to account for the sort of zero inflated TCU scores, and then multinomial regression to look at binging. So we have 7 communities and 172 participants clustered in those communities. From time one to time two, looking at the clustering of participants within these 7 communities, it was, we had a really small ICC, so 5% of variance was sort of explained by substance use in one community being different from the other community, being different from the other community. So it just indicates that at this point we don't need to account for clustering too much or add network club, or I'm sorry, neighborhood level predictors. So our sample looks like they're mostly about half women. Each housing community, we sampled about 24 people, between 15 and 38 people from each community. Mostly unemployed, mostly had not graduated from high school, or had not achieved a high school education, full high school education. Almost everybody in the sample reported less than $15,000 annual income. And this is where they moved to. The little white blocks are the housing communities that were demolished, and the black dots are where people moved to. I think the median move was about 5 miles, and this scale is from 0 to 10 miles, just to get a sense of where people are going. They're not going terribly far. And here are the basic network variables and how they've changed pre-location, post-location. So the network size, the total network size, was about 5.6 and then 5.4 at each time point. Not significant change there. However, the composition seems to have changed pretty significantly for every one of the sort of relational categories and in different directions. So we sort of see increases in family members that are nominated post-relocation, increases in peers, and decreases in the other three categories of social network members. For social support, none of the changes were significant, except for the financial trust category. And we basically asked a couple questions about how well, if there's someone who you could trust to lend money to and they would bring your groceries back. It's sort of two questions about sort of financial trust. And there was significant change there in, I guess, a positive direction, you might say. This is just the distribution of dependency scores at the bottom and binging scores. So for the final models, we did see significant declines in dependency scores, and we saw bordering on significant changes in binging. I'm not really going to talk about the results for binging because I'm sort of talking with a biostatistician about sort of reconsidering our model for the way that we're modeling binging. But the only thing that came out significant in this model anyhow is change in number of alcohol misusers in your network was associated with binging scores at time two. For the drug dependency scores, we surprisingly didn't see any significant change in illicit drug users in the social network. That didn't come out as significant, but sexual partners, sort of the network composition of sexual partners in the last 60 days and the level of financial trust, both of those were significant in predicting TCU scores at the time, too. These are sort of preliminary models. Frankly, working on gender, age hasn't really made any difference in these estimates. Gender seems to be important in terms of men having higher TCU scores than women, but we're sort of working towards linear growth models. Sort of once we get a couple more waves of data, we'll be able to sort of see whether the slopes are different for men and women in a more sophisticated way. So not stunning conclusions at this point from our study, but network size seems to be relatively stable, and that's important for preliminary findings or initial findings from this study. So there's been pretty little change there, and perhaps important changes in network composition, particularly within the social support category. Obviously, we saw some change in financial trust dimension of social support and general declines in drug dependency. I guess when you think about the broader research and how this relates to Watkins' study in Baltimore and some of the other social network findings, I guess what I would conclude sort of tentatively at this point is that we see that sort of the social cohesion seems to be important if you consider that our population is increasing the number of family members and peers and also increasing the number of people that they have sort of financial trust in. Those are collinear, and we're going to sort of parse out how different the effects from increased financial trust and increased sort of family members are, but I'm not sure if parsing out those differences really matter in terms of thinking theoretically about what's happening here. We didn't see the drops in injection drug users as being significant. A significant predictor the way that Watkin did. However, our study is including a broader sample of people who are at risk for drug dependency and not focused only on injection drug users. So I think I'm pretty close on time. So, yeah, obviously this isn't a representative sample, so that's a limitation. Neighborhood changes over time especially are going to affect these outcomes, and it may interact with social network change. And future analyses will explore change across all waves of data. So we'll have some really exciting findings over time. I think that what we're looking at now is important, but yeah, we'll be able to model sort of trajectories of substance use much better over time as we finish cleaning and putting together all our waves of data. One more thing, I guess, in terms of limitations. Because we did recruit substance users that were scoring high, there's going to be obviously a concern to watch, and it will be minimized over time about regression to the mean. So if we're including participants in our study who are scoring sort of extremely high on drug dependency, there's some concern looking at just wave one and wave two that may be an issue. There's also sort of test-retest effects. But over time, since we're asking people the same questions, we'll be able to kind of monitor and account for that. I'm not going to read these, but these are all the acknowledgments. I'd like to thank Dr. Cooper, who's here, for letting me work on this data and struggle through it. These are my references, which I think are pretty good if you're interested in the topic. Thank you.